The Guardian.
Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis here on Friday, May the 2nd. Today, Labour is licking its wounds after its worst local election results for 40 years.
Labour has not listened for a long time to the people. When parliamentarians think they know better than the people that elect them, then there is some cause for concern.
The Conservatives have won crucial councils in the north of England, putting them on course to win the general election.
I finally now have got the results coming through to my BlackBerry, which everyone else was getting ages before. I think people are probably sitting about 50 yards down there. I could actually go and ask them, but it's a good service, actually, because it's faster than the BBC.
And in other news, the government has failed to act against ballot fraud because it's worried about upsetting ethnic minorities.
Because actually Labour might think that they've been benefiting from some of this fraud, which is an extraordinary thing for Labour MPs themselves to admit in public in a select committee hearing.
And in Austria, police try to piece together how Josef Fritzl managed to get away with locking his daughter in his cellar for 24 years.
Josef Fritzl himself says that he had put a timer mechanism on the door, which meant that if anything happened to him, if he died, that after some time the door would open of its own accord.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis from guardian.co.uk.
But before we hear about any of that, here's Sandy Waugh with today's news headlines and a look at what the papers are saying.
In the local elections, Labour have had their worst result for more than 30 years, dropping to third place in the national share of votes behind the Liberal Democrats. The Conservatives have done well enough to be on course for a general election victory. They also broke through to have taken seats in the north of England as well, including winning Bury Council in Lancashire. And they took over councils in Nuneaton and Bedworth in the Midlands and Harlow in the southeast. The Liberal Democrats have gained the council in Hull and held on to Liverpool against a Labour challenge. President Bush has asked Congress to vote nearly $800 million to help the world food crisis. At the White House, he said he wanted to give the money to world food and development programs because of the steep rise in food prices. He wants the money to go mainly to Africa, and it would involve direct shipments of food. And as the Middle East peace conference gathers in London, aid agencies have called for an end to the humanitarian crisis in Gaza. The agencies said the Israeli blockade had made the conditions there intolerable because only a trickle of medicine, fuel and food was being allowed in. Hundreds of thousands could only get water every 4 days, and the agencies called for an immediate and full reopening of the border for supplies. As she flew into London, the US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice called on Arab nations to fulfil their promises of aid to the Palestinians. The United States has released a cameraman working for TV station Al Jazeera from Guantanamo. Sami Al-Hajj was arrested on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan in December 2001. It was alleged he was working for Al-Qaeda and was taken to Guantanamo, but was never tried. Another British football club has reached a European Cup final. Rangers beat Fiorentina in Italy in the UEFA Cup, but they had to go to a penalty shootout to make it and will face Zenit St. Petersburg for the title. Well, the late editions of the papers have had time to include the election results. The Guardian says Brown faces election mauling. The Telegraph splashes a front-page story about China building a secret nuclear submarine base. The Times tells us that the General Teaching Council believes there are 24,000 teachers who are so bad they need retraining. And the Mail says the number of women and girls arrested for drunkenness has gone up by 50% in 5 years. On the back pages, it's still looking as if Chelsea football manager Avram Grant is under threat, while the Portuguese manager Felipe Scolari is in line to take over at Manchester City. More on the day's news plus breaking stories at guardian.co.uk.
The local elections in England and Wales are the first electoral test for Gordon Brown as Prime Minister. About 4,000 seats on 160 local councils were at stake, and the voters have given Brown a clobbering. Labour's national share has fallen to 24%. That's the lowest it's been since records began in the early 1970s. David Cameron's Conservative Party has gained seats from Labour in the north of England, in the south and in the Midlands. And it may get worse for Gordon Brown later today. today when the result of the London mayoral election are announced. With me to discuss the results are Julian Glover, The Guardian's chief leader writer, and Allegra Stratton, who's been blogging heroically throughout the night as the results have been coming in. Allegra, we haven't got all the results yet, but what's the picture so far?
Oh, it's terrible for Labour. I mean, it's the results have been spun that if they did as badly as the last time all these seats were up, which was 2004, then they wouldn't do as badly as that. That was such a low that they couldn't do possibly as badly as that. And they did. They did 2% worse than that. So they came in at 24%. Tories have come in at 44%. This is good. It's not quite as high as the 47% that Labour were getting 2 years before they went on for their landslide 1997 election. So it's good, but it's not quite brilliant enough. Lib Dems have had a good night. They've come in at 25%, which is obviously one ahead of Labour. But also, they haven't had many gains in terms of seats. They're at the moment on 10, and there's been some kind of jiggery pokery with Liverpool Council, which they have kept, but only by doing a deal immediately after the results came through.
Julian, Labour did its best to lower our expectations of how they would do in these elections. Has there been any glimmer of hope for Labour from these results?
None at all, really. It's pretty terrible. I think they thought they wouldn't do quite as badly as this. They thought it would be pretty grim. This is a real shock to them. It's also a lesson that if you go into a local election campaign, having had a mess over 10p tax, having had a prime minister under fire, having had rebellions in the House of Commons, the voters will punish you. And they have. Labour fought this election as badly as they could, and they've really suffered for it.
And all night, all the ministers that were trotted out on television, they were ashen-faced. They had no defence to muster. And you have people like Andy Burnham saying, you know, we welcome the fight. This is now a fight with the Tories.
And some ministers are in danger of losing their seats if tonight's results were repeated in a general election.
Yes, we move immediately to talking about the general election, speculating about the future. We ought to point out, because it's the dutiful thing one should say, that this is a local election. And some people were voting on local issues for their local council. It wasn't a national opinion poll. In fact, I would say that if you want to know what's going to happen at the next election, or if there was an election straight away, look at the Guardian's ICM polls, which are a very good test of national opinion. This is a test of local opinion in certain rather random bits of the country, too. Nowhere in Scotland voted. Lots of England didn't get to vote. It's the smallest set of local elections there is in the annual sort of cycle of elections. Despite all that, it's terrible for Labour. I think the assumption in the party will grow that they're going to lose the next election. That's already becoming the assumption amongst a lot of journalists. It's something dramatic will have to happen. Certainly, I can't see any way from these results, barring calamity for the Conservative Party, for Labour to win a majority at the next election. Long way, as Allegra says, for the Tories doing well enough to kind of be sure of a landslide victory like 1997. That's deeply improbable. But getting a majority, that looks too much of a tough ask.
One point in the night when Southampton came, it was a real shock that Southampton came through for the Tories. I don't think they thought that they would take that. And it's very interesting because it's John Denham's seat. Now, as Julian says, you know, this is not a general election. This has nothing to do with MPs in many ways. But John Denham is a cabinet minister, who's written about the problem that Labour have in the South. They have to keep the coalition going. And if they don't keep their voters in the South, then the whole thing splinters. And it's his area that's come through to be vulnerable.
Well, Labour needs to keep voters in the South, and the Tories need to make headway in the North, and they've done that overnight. Let's hear David Cameron react at Tory HQ to his party's victory in Bury.
We've just won Bury, which is vital council in the northwest of England, which really has got full of marginal seats, absolutely vital for us to win, and it's been a really hard fight, and we've done it, and it's great.
Julian, can the Conservatives be happy with their performance in the north?
I think they'll be thrilled with their performance across the country. And we talk a lot, it's fashionable in the media, to talk of the Tory challenge in the north, as though there are no Tories in the north of England. In fact, if you go to the north of England, which I do pretty regularly, it's a pretty conservative place. There are a lot of big towns that vote Labour. There's a lot of rural areas that vote conservative. There are more conservative councils in the northwest even before tonight's elections than there are conservative ones. Tories stood in every council ward in Yorkshire. Labour Party didn't. So there's a bit of a myth that the north is a no-go zone for the Tories. I think that should be put to one side. And there's always been some Tory MPs. What there are a lot of marginal seats, as Cameron said. He has to win places in the northwest of England. He's got to win in Bury. But he also needs to do well in the south. And that, in the end, is what will determine Labour's fate, not the north. That might build the Tory majority. But if Brown loses power, it will be because places like Southampton, where some of the two marginal seats in Southampton went Labour in 1992, 1997, quite early on, even before Blair, if those go, No hope for Labour.
Also Reading, which will declare at lunchtime, that's the last of three big, well, it's the biggest of three Labour councils in the South, and it will go, that's gone. And that's the last heartland of Labour in the South.
Well, it's interesting that even in Labour heartlands, voters are expressing their discomfort with what's been going on nationally. Martin Wainwright is The Guardian's Northern editor, and he's been in Barnsley to find out the reaction there.
You'd think that if anywhere I was going to stay Labour, it would be Barnsley, Arthur Scargill's old stamping ground in the heartland of the former Yorkshire coalfield. But they've only just held on here. Looks like the majority is going to be one. It was three over a coalition of independents who are very strong in Barnsley. A lot of them are ex-Labour, some ex-Tory, some ex-Liberal. They've seen off the British National Party, who mounted a strong challenge, but there's a lot of concern that although the BNP didn't win any actual wards, it polled quite well overall. They were getting things like 500, 600, that sort of thing, where the winning councillor was getting 1,000, 1,200. So that's a significant factor. But I've just been talking to Steve Houghton, the council leader, who retains his position as council leader. He says that the recent controversy over the 10p tax band has been devastating on the party, and it's a message he wants to take down to London as urgently as possible.
Labour didn't listen to the people, and a lot of people had been adversely affected.
And I would guess, especially in an area like this, where the wages, by and large, will be low.
Very low. There's not a lot of difference between unemployment benefit and the minimum wage. £6, £7 and £8 a week to some of these people is very significant.
Julian, how important then was the 10p income tax fiasco?
I think it's important in two ways, and we can't judge it exactly. I think one was it knocked Labour confidence internally. MPs suddenly just got assaulted by their voters with letters and complaints, but also they suddenly thought, gosh, what is all this about? Why are we in government even? What are we trying to do? So it sort of demolished their internal confidence, just as the Tories lost confidence in the 90s when they were in power, and it really, really annoyed a lot of Labour voters. And I think they didn't like the policy, and above all, they didn't like the Prime Minister's response. And fundamentally, I think that's the big thing from tonight. It's not the detail of policy. It's that this was the first election Gordon Brown's ever fought. He isn't a Prime Minister who's won general elections and can just say, well, this is a midterm result. Gosh, what a terrible thing. But nonetheless, I keep winning general elections. Blair could say that because Blair got pastings in local elections too. But this is Brown's first time. He's a big, shiny new Prime Minister. He comes along and the voters blow a big raspberry, not just as bad as Tony Blair's bad days, worse than, you know, Jim Callaghan, worse than Foote. This is a public that really doesn't want Gordon Brown to be Prime Minister. And I think the 10p tax was part of that. They just see a man who comes from Scotland, no elections in Scotland this time, of course, so that doesn't help him, who doesn't seem to listen, doesn't really care for them, and he's going to have to change.
I saw one interesting poll today, a BBC poll. I mean, yeah, he's in trouble, but in terms of the economy, which 10p tax is sort of part of the economy, it's part of the feeling that people's money isn't going as far these days. And there was a poll done by the BBC that showed that Brown's economic competence record had crashed. 32% of respondents thought that the Tories were economically competent, and that was 4% up on last year. In terms of what they need to be improving on, they haven't actually made inroads yet.
That's true, but that's always also the case with oppositions, that governments get in trouble. People don't fall in love with the opposition. I don't think Labour's economic competence records in opposition were that high either. It's just that they became more solid than the Conservative parties. But the story of tonight is Labour in trouble, not Tories. The nation's not falling in love with the Tories. They're just slipping into their arms because there's no one else available.
As we've discussed, the first electoral test for Gordon Brown, he's pretty much flunked it. It was also a big test for the Liberal Democrats, Nick Clegg's first election as leader. They were in danger of being squeezed by Labour in the north and the Conservatives in the south. Allegra, what kind of night have the Liberal Democrats had?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, Liverpool. So Liverpool was their baby. They held Liverpool, and they only ended up holding it by they lost it by one. And then immediately after the results were declared, the leader, the Liberal Democrat leader of the council, went up to an independent, persuaded her to come over to their side, and thereby they got their majority again. And Sarah Tether was on television saying that this was absolutely fine because this just illustrated how unpopular Labour was, and so as such was absolutely politically fair game. But actually, I think some people think it was pretty dodgy. Anyway, that was their big story this evening. They also got Hull. They are on 25%, so they're second largest party at the moment, but they're down on 2004 when they were 29%. And also quite significantly, Ming Campbell was booted out because he got 26%. of at last year's local elections. That was seen to be not good enough. And actually, Clegg's got 1% less. But I was blogging all night and I put this question to the bloggers and they all said, no, 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 actually coming second, beating Labour, he's not done badly.
It could have gone badly. It hasn't gone badly, so it's fine. The only story in town is Gordon Brown, but there would have been a sub-story of Nick Clegg in crisis if he'd come third. Actually, it was 27% in 2004, so it's just a little bit lower than this. It was 25% in 2006 and 26% in 2007. So this is pretty much the standard Lib Dem performance, and they'll be happy enough with that, although they won't be too thrilled. Hull, they'll cheer them up because they always like winning something. They've got some hopes in Sheffield too, which is Nick Clegg's hometown, when that comes through in the afternoon. But it wasn't spectacular. Just one thing we ought to point out, all these share of the vote figures aren't really actual share of the vote figures. There's something called national vote equivalent, which is calculated by mystery people at the BBC overnight, who count from certain selected wards across the country. Even they don't like them that much. It's just that we in the media demand these figures because we can't discuss elections in local terms. And then in a couple of weeks, some other academics will come up with another set of figures. It has happened before that Lib Dems have moved from second to third in the rival academics' figures and nobody noticed. So we should put a little qualification on the idea that the Tories got 44%. They sort of got 44%. Yeah. That's an estimate.
Well, Allegra's been blogging for The Guardian overnight, but let's have a look at what some of the other political blogs have been saying.
The Conservative blogs are very excited and hardly anyone is even speaking up for Labour. The Spectator's Coffeehouse blog says that if tonight's results were repeated in a general election, the Tories would have a majority of 138. As they put it at 4 a.m, Jeremy Vine has just sent a chill down the spine of Labour MPs. Conservative Home has led the way in projecting a win for Boris Johnson over Ken Livingstone to become London mayor, which it bases on reports from Tory activists in the London suburbs, where it says turnout has been huge. Daniel Hannan on the Telegraph website says simply that Labour has been hammered. Labour Home is already debating the possibilities of a cabinet reshuffle, and the Labour Representation Committee, one of the only Labour blogs to stay up through the night, quotes its man, John McDonnell MP, "Labour is in danger of sleepwalking into a Tory government." Nick Robinson of the BBC sums up, "Bad for Labour, very bad, and with worse likely to follow."
Well, Allegra, you know, do you think the blogs got it right? They were calling for Boris before anybody else, apparently, the Conservative
Home
website.
The Tory ones were. Yeah. What a surprise. The interesting thing is that they think that, that turnout's quite high, especially in Hackney. Supposedly 47% of people have turned out to vote in London. And so, they're, you know, I think that's the small shred of hope that Labour's clinging to, that high turnout might possibly swing it for them. But Labour people on telly overnight Labour people on telly overnight were basically counting it as gone.
Well, thanks very much, Julian and Allegra. We'll come back to you before the end of the podcast when we'll look in a bit more detail at the London mayoral election. So there's more politics later on, but there's full coverage of today's elections at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, is Italy returning to fascism? Tobias Jones, author of The Dark Heart of Italy, thinks not. Find out why at guardian.co.uk/Italy. Alexis Petridis on wonky pop, how a new generation is trying to break Simon Cowell's grip on pop and redefine the charts. Read what he says at guardian.co.uk/music. And the film director Spike Lee blogs exclusively for us about his new role as a champion of internet movies. He's jury president of the Babel Gum Online Film Festival. He's at blogs.guardian.co.uk/film. The government has failed to act against ballot fraud because it's worried about fueling controversy in ethnic minority communities, which is where most cases of abuse have been uncovered. Well, that's the view of a Labour-dominated group of MPs who've carried out an investigation into constitutional reform. Patrick Winter is The Guardian's political editor. He told Guardian Daily's Phil Maynard that it's a damning verdict from the Select Committee.
Well, what it is they've been taking evidence from ministers about constitutional reform, and they held a session this week in which they intervened very severely on the minister, Michael Wills, and said he'd been complacent and the government had been complacent about the way in which they've allowed the spread of postal balloting without any sufficient checks as to whether the people who are using these postal votes are indeed genuine voters. And there's been a large number of examples of fraud, about 40 cases where there's been convictions, and there's a concern that this now is spreading more widely. And what the Labour MPs on the committee were saying is that they're worried that Labour has been slow to act on this, partly because there's been people in the minority communities, particularly from Pakistan, who've been most prone to using these techniques. And secondly, they've been concerned that Labour's been slow to act because actually Labour might think that they've been benefiting from some of this fraud, which is an extraordinary thing for Labour MPs themselves to admit in public in a select committee hearing.
So is postal ballot fraud thought to be widespread?
Well, it's very hard to tell because fraud undetected is fraud undetected, but there's been so far 40 convictions. Police think that that's maybe there's been about 200 cases, and some of them may have been quite widespread. But I think what there is a concern that it's now clear how you can commit this fraud and that the system is very open to it, and whether there now needs to be some checks and some restraints. The reasons why it's happened is that the Labour government wanted to increase turnout, which is a very legitimate thing to want to do, and they therefore made it much easier to have postal ballots.
This is going to cause a bit of a stir then, isn't it?
Well, I think it will cause a storm inside the Labour circles because they've both accused the minority communities, ethnic communities in essence, of being primarily responsible, which is quite a thing to admit and to charge. And the second is to say that there have been some people in the Labour government who've been slow to act on this out of really party self-interest.
That's Patrick Winter. I'm John Dennis. Still to come in Guardian Daily, more from Julian Glover and Allegra Stratton with a look at the London mayoral elections. Has Boris Johnson beaten Ken Livingstone? And we'll go to Cardiff for a taste of Europe's first drive-through coffee shop.
I think it's a fantastic venture. I suppose, you know, kind of closest thing is kind of the usual Burger King, McDonald's, but this is taking a coffee a step up.
No, I won't be using it.
Why not?
Too dear.
But first, detectives in Austria investigating Joseph Fritzl's imprisonment of his daughter for 24 years in a dungeon have appealed to his former lodgers to come forward with information. Kate Connolly is in Amstetten for The Guardian. She told Guardian Daily's Andy Duckworth that family members have described Fritzl as a despot who ruled by fear.
The new appeal is to the around 100 people who have lived in what the police themselves are calling the House of Horrors in Ipser Street in Amstetten over the course of about 25 to 30 years. Now, they're hoping that these people, even if they think they have nothing to report, will come forward and may be able to throw some sort of light on either the man or his behaviour or anything to do with the building of the cellar and the dungeon, which we believe began in about 1978 and took several years to complete.
Away from the police investigation, some others have been trying to paint a picture of this man that was capable of doing this. Who have been speaking to the press?
Yes, well, what we've had the first member of the family, a woman called Christina, who has spoken to one Austrian newspaper. She is the sister of Rosemary Fritzl, the wife of Josef Fritzl, her younger sister. And she has painted a picture of a tyrant, a man who the family never liked. Her sister, she says, married him when she was a mere 17-year-old, and she didn't have an education or a job and was therefore basically, over the years, basically at his beck and call the whole time, very subservient to him. She said the family never liked him, that the lack of respect for him increased greatly when in 1967 he was convicted for raping a woman in Linz. This woman he raped in Linz in 1967, she has also come forward saying how horrified she was to see pictures of the man she could never forget on her television screen, who had climbed in through her open window and raped her in her bed in Linz, in her home. And she said that she felt great relief that that he was now in custody, and her hope that that he would be brought to trial and convicted.
On a more positive note, following their horrific ordeal, some good news about the children involved.
Yes, I mean, we understand that two of the three children who were held in the dungeon who have never seen the light of day, or had never seen the light of day until they were released on a Saturday evening. They are being treated in a nearby clinic, and the psychiatrist looking after them said that they're doing remarkably well health wise. Under the circumstances, they're in a good state. Their teeth are said to not be in a very good condition because of the vitamin D deficiency that they've had. But at the same time, on a more positive note, they are embracing the real world that they've never known before. We've had some very moving reports from the police officer who was one of the first to encounter them, Leopold Etz, who has talked of their encounters or their sightings for the first time of things like a cow or a mountain stream or an elevator, who, when the doors of the elevator opened, five-year-old Felix was absolutely terrified, not knowing what was going to come out of it, but also mixed with delight at seeing things like the moon and the sun, when sun rays hit his face, how he touches his face and is just quite overwhelmed with what he's experiencing. The psychiatrist who's the head of the clinic and is treating them, Berthold Kettlinger, has said that there are two major things that they're going to have to work on in the next couple of weeks. One is the fact that they're just not used to sunlight, and the other thing is that they have no sense of spatial awareness whatsoever, having been cooped up in this very, very tiny space all their lives. And that's they're two of the aspects that they said that they're hoping they'll see signs of improvement in over the next few days and weeks.
Guardian Daily, news and reports from around the world.
Britain's coffee shops could be about to face a new kind of competition. Starbucks has opened Europe's first drive-through branch. The Guardian's Stephen Morris rolled up to the branch in Cardiff for a large macchiato and found a mixed reaction among locals.
Drive along to the window, and here we are. Hello there, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Getting good. Used to this whole concept of drive-through. People in my ears. But we're getting there slowly.
Fantastic, thank
you.
Okay? I'm very well indeed, thanks.
There are 2,000 drive-through Starbucks coffee shops in the US. This one in Cardiff Bay is Europe's first. It's very similar to a drive-through burger joint. You order at an intercom system and seconds later pick up your drink from a window. If the Cardiff branch takes off, expect one on a street corner near you soon. But who's going to use this sort of place? Surely the point of a coffee shop is to relax, have a chat, watch the world go by for a bit. Not according to these satisfied customers.
Cool. We've all been on about it in work for ages because we work over in IKEA, and we're all sort of excited to have one before work and stuff. It's really sad. Because we've seen it, we pass it all the time, so when it's been opening and stuff. It's really excited.
So where are you going to drink yours?
I'll probably go over to work now. I start work, so I'll just have it in the office.
So it's very convenient. I guess some people might say you could just jump out and grab a coffee from
the
local.
Yeah, definitely. It's like on the way, just grab it. And it only took 2 seconds, so it should be cool. It should be convenient.
And you were one of the first customers at this new drive-through Starbucks. What do you make of it so far?
I think it's a fantastic venture. Hopefully it'll catch on. I suppose, kind of closest thing is the usual Burger King McDonald's, but this is taking a coffee a step up, so hopefully we'll see quite a few more in and around the cities.
Yeah, my name's Henry Trickey, and I'm the Director of Real Estate and Store Development for Starbucks Coffee Company in the UK and Ireland.
So why Cardiff, Henry?
Well, Cardiff we've been trading in for just over 7 years now. We've got nearly 10 stores, and we've developed a very good relationship with our customer base, and we have a very loyal customer group in Cardiff, so the brand is very well established. It's a very vibrant, exciting city, and we've decided that our first drive-through in Europe, which is a very innovative concept, we would do very well in Wales, in Cardiff.
Not everybody is so convinced. Locals at the nearby Black and White Cafe, a good old-fashioned egg and chip sort of place, are baffled at the idea of a Starbucks drive-through. So tell me, Carl, what do you make of this drive-through Starbucks? Will you be using it?
No, I won't be using it.
Why not?
Too dear.
How much you pay for a cup of coffee in here?
70 pence.
A decent cup of coffee?
Really good.
Best in Cardiff?
Yeah.
How often do you come here?
Every other day. For the last 30-odd years.
So what do you make of a drive-through Starbucks up the road?
Well, not for this car, is it? Not for this. Nice, comfortable in here. Good people own it. Would happy year to me, young.
A caffeine-crazed Stephen Morris reporting from Cardiff.
In today's Football Weekly Extra, in a week that saw Ronaldo brought down by three very unexpected tackles, we look back at the Champions League midweek action as Man United and Chelsea prepare to contest the first ever All-English Champions League final. There's the Championship, down to the last weekend with everything still to be decided. Is it in the bag for the Baggies? Will Stoke choke? Etc. and so on. Elsewhere, we got a report from Spain from our very own Sid Lowe. We got the latest from Italy and France too, your post, and a look forward to the penultimate round of the Premier League. Squeaky bums? We haven't seen bums this squeaky since those Richard Gere and hamsters rumours. That's all in Football Weekly Extra. For details, go to guardian.co.uk/football.
Well, as we've heard earlier in the show, it's been a terrible election night for Labour in the local councils. Later today, we'll know whether Ken Livingstone has lost to Boris Johnson in the contest for London Mayor. Vincent Cable, the Liberal Democrats' deputy leader, said earlier that he believed that Boris Johnson had won. Privately, Labour insiders are saying the same thing. Well, Julian Glover and Allegra Stratton are still here. Julian, do these council election results give us any clues as to what might happen in London?
Well, they give us a bit of a clue, which is Labour's doing badly, and therefore the Tories must be doing well, and Johnson's the likely winner. But certainly he hasn't yet been confirmed as the winner, and it doesn't do Labour any harm to talk down their hopes now, because if they suddenly did come back late in the afternoon and win in London, we might change the story quite a lot and suddenly forget that we were thinking the Tories were doing well after all. So I'll put a bit of salt onto those Labour claims.
Well, Allegra, might Labour be helped by a high turnout?
That's certainly what they're spinning. Supposedly there's been 47% turnout in Hackney, an area that doesn't traditionally vote that highly. And turnout has traditionally been thought to be good for Labour. So I think that's the line that they've put out, which sort of goes against what you've said. But that's the one thing I've seen that they're clinging to, that they're saying, hold on a second, it's not over yet.
How important is London?
It's been a love-hate relationship between Livingstone and Brown for quite a while. So it's odd that Livingstone losing could come to be seen to be so bad for Brown.
It's ironic that old enemies Gordon Brown and Ken Livingstone, to a certain extent, Brown's political career depends on the success of Ken Livingstone.
A little bit of that, yes. I mean, they'll probably go down together. It looks like in London, the outer London is extremely conservative, and turnout has been high there as well, perhaps even higher than Hackney in places. So perhaps what we're just seeing is people excited by politics, and everybody from all parties is thrilled by it. One crucial thing for London is that this was a job created by Labour. It was sort of created for a Labour mayor. They don't think when they set it up they ever envisaged losing it. And when they lose it, if they lose it, the most important Labour figure in Britain after the Prime Minister and national government will be Manchester City Council and the leader of that. And suddenly, this idea we've got used to over the last decade or so, that Labour is the party of power, and that in much of Britain they're the biggest party, they're the ones that naturally win, take control in Scotland, in Wales, wherever there's a job, it's probably a Labour guy going to get it. Well, that's gone, really, and if London goes, Gordon Brown's going to look quite lonely. He'll head the government, he'll have all the power, but he won't have any backup anywhere else, and that could be crucial at a general election.
What I think is quite interesting, if Boris does win, not when Boris, but if he does, all these councils that we've seen over the last however long, which have started, for instance, like in Enfield, which I went to Sunday of last week, where they have quite a large surplus, but they are slashing third sector spending. So all these, some policies that for a while David Cameron has floated as his new look conservatism, some of the councils are not quite acting on. And it will be very interesting to see if he gets it, what Boris will do with London in the run-up to a general election.
Julian, is there time for Boris to screw things up before the general election? The Labour could point to that as an example of how the Tories aren't fit for government.
They could certainly try, and Boris is going to be pretty high profile if he does win, and we must keep saying he hasn't won yet, and that Ken Livingstone could still be mayor tomorrow morning.
But Julian, will they let him screw it up? Will the
Well, I think there's two things. First of all, I think a lot of people assume that somehow Ken Livingstone's a wonderful mayor and that Boris Johnson is naturally incompetent and will be useless. I don't share that view. I know other people feel that quite strongly. I think Ken Livingstone has been a pretty weak mayor in lots of ways, and he's been surrounded by some people who've been pretty controversial. And him staying in office too could help Labour suffer. I think they may not mind the back of him if it wasn't a Tory coming in. But yes, Boris could have a lot of problems. And there's two areas, I think, where there could be problems. One is Crossrail, which is the transport project everybody in London needs and wants, but the money is going to be very hard to find, and Brown could make it even harder just to punish the Tories. And the other is the Olympics, because this mayor's term will end a couple of weeks before the Olympic Games begin. And if that goes wrong, although that will be after the general election, that will be Boris Johnson's fault. And so he's going to be tagged with the Olympics now. That's quite a hard thing for this man to sort out.
And just looking finally, Julian, at Gordon Brown, will there be a challenge to his leadership?
Oh, I shouldn't think so. It's not really in Labour's DNA to do that. But what there might be is just a lot of people rather hoping he sort of disappears, but I don't think he will.
Yeah, very menacing comments overnight. Ian Gibson saying, "We're here to help." You know, Brown won't want to hear that.
Yes, if Gordon Brown suddenly decided to take a top job at the IMF, then maybe he wouldn't have too many people failing to sign the leaving card. But no, I think he'll be around. And yeah, they have got time. I mean, we must emphasise that,
yes,
too. This isn't the year before general election. Some people thought it might be a while ago, but I think the general election will be 2010. That's a bit of time for things to turn around.
For the economy to take upturn.
And let's not forget that Tony Blair won the general election in 2005 after losing disastrously in the local elections in 2004.
Yes, although the Tories got 37% then, not 44.
So a big difference.
That's quite a difference.
OK, well, many thanks to both Allegra Stratton and Julian Glover for joining us. And after the mayoral election results are announced later today, you can listen to a special edition of our Politics Weekly podcast, hosted by Jackie Ashley from City Hall in London. That's at guardian.co.uk/audio. Today's Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard, Andy Duckworth and Tim Mabey. I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.